Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, the NHL Stanley Cup Final is starting tonight. And it's the Chicago Blackhawks versus the Tampa Bay Lightning playing for the coveted cup, the hardest championship trophy to win in all of sports. Like I said, Lightning versus Blackhawks. And today on Talk is Jericho, I got the greatest Chicago Blackhawk of all time, NHL Hall of Famer, the greatest Winnipeg Jet of all time, the Golden Jet himself, Bobby Hull, is going to be here. Let me tell you one thing about Bobby Hull. If you grew up in the 70s in Winnipeg, Bobby Hull was our hero. He was the man. And if you grew up in Chicago in the 60s, he was the king of the Blackhawks, still the greatest Blackhawk of all time. How apropos that on the eve of the Chicago Blackhawks entering the Stanley Cup Final, I got Bobby Hull here. It's amazing, amazing story. I'm ready to talk old-time hockey with one of the greatest to ever step on the ice. He's actually in my family, too. It's really funny. His my brother-in-law's mother's cousin is married to Bobby. So one day at Easter, I came into my brother-in-law's mom's house, and I said hi to everyone. And I was like, is that Bobby Hull in the corner? And they're like, yes. I was like, ah, we'll talk all about that. One of my childhood heroes, Bobby Hull.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. Let's go for a ride with our friends at Burger King. That's right. How do you capture the flaky, buttery lightness of your favorite breakfast sandwich? By saying croissant-wich. All right. You can do that. Say it with me now. Croissant-wich. You get two of these amazing, amazing croissant-wiches for $4. That's right, 2 for $4 only at Burger King. Restrictions apply, all right? Don't forget, you want a nice, tasty snack? Go to Burger King in the morning and have yourself a croissant-wich. And today, all right, I got one of the greatest Chicago Blackhawks of all time, one of the greatest NHL legends of all time. He is a living legend, and I talked to him face-to-face in Chicago a few weeks ago. He's an NHL Hall of Famer. He's the Golden Jet, one of the greatest Winnipeg Jets of all time. Bobby Hull is on Talk is Jericho today, and I'm telling you right now, I'm super excited to have him on, one of my childhood heroes from the 70s. 80s, I was more of a Paul Stanley Hulk Hogan guy. 70s, it was Henry Winkler and Bobby Hull. I got three of those four guys on this show already. Henry Winkler, I'm coming for you. All right. You know, once you get a chance to listen to Bobby, whether you love hockey, whether you don't, trust me, it's a great, great storytelling time. Bobby's been around for a very, very long time. Has a lot of great tales to tell. And there's a lot of laughs on that show. And also a lot of laughs on my new Comedy Central digital series, Nothing to Report. Thanks to all of you who've already watched it. We're well over 1 million views already at this point in just over a month. You know what that means, too. The more views that we get, the more times you see it, the more chance we get to do more of these shows. I want you to go to YouTube. Help me out. There's 6 episodes. They're 5 minutes each. Golden nuggets of comedy genius. Go on to ComedyCentral.com. Go to YouTube. Type in Nothing to Report and get ready to laugh your collective arses off, as Seamus would say. Listen, we want to do more of these. We want to do more episodes. We want to do a pilot. We want to actually take this thing to series. Go to YouTube. Go to ComedyCentral.com. Type in Nothing to Report and help a brother out. And that brother would be me. All right, speaking of brothers, I talked to you last week about losing a good friend of mine, Daniel House, passed away from cancer, liver cancer. Ended up being a really, really good friend of mine over the last year and a half, and a guy that I looked up to in a lot of ways because he was very much, courageous guy and a very funny guy. and somebody that I became quite close to over the last, like I said, year and a half. Actually, he was even on Talk Is Jericho, if you want to check him out and hear what he had to say. A man who is facing death, facing cancer, and trying to beat it. He did beat it way longer than anybody ever thought he would. He recently succumbed to that disease. But he was on Talk Is Jericho. If you want to see that, go to YouTube and type in Talk Is Jericho. Daniel House. House, like the TV series about the cranky old doctor, whatever the hell he was. But when I talked to Daniel, I remember asking him, like, have you prepared your own funeral? And that was one of the things that he did, because he had a real long kind of a battle with cancer, and he kind of got all of his affairs in order. And one of those affairs was putting together his own funeral. And that's kind of something strange to think about that. Like, if you got to plan your own funeral, how would you do it? What would you do? Well, let me tell you what Daniel did on his funeral. And this is actually a very fun story. And this is the way I like to remember my bud. Daniel's friend, mutual friend, guy called Gareth, was Daniel's best man at his wedding. And he passed along to me this rundown of Daniel's funeral. So I'm just kind of go through it and read some of the highlights out to you so you can see what type of a guy he is and what type of a funeral we should all have, all right? Because it should be a celebration, not something sad. If we had our way, we'd want people to remember our lives with a smile. You know, I want people to be laughing when they think of Jericho. Like, man, that guy was such an idiot. That sort of thing. But check out what Dan did. This is from Gareth. He said, Dan had every detail organized. It only took a few minutes to see what kind of direction this funeral was going to take. When the montage of photos projected up on the wall of the chapel were accompanied by the very familiar opening piano of Fozzy's SOS, had those of us in the know smiling like idiots. Michaela had done a great job choosing the photos with a few surprises and an appearance of not only you, Chris Jericho, but also licking the Dan on a stick. Not only of you licking Dan on a stick, but the whole band. What that means is we had a couple great fans in England that they become friends with Daniel because of the mutual love of Fozzy. And they'd made these, you know, the thing that's really in vogue now is cutting out taking a picture of somebody's face and blowing it up and then cutting out the silhouette of the face and putting it on a stick. Have you guys seen this in the audience at Raw or at rock shows? So when we did the last European tour, Julie Noobs and Lise did this, you know, we'd be playing and there'd be giant distended Daniel House heads bobbing in the crowd. So I grabbed one and licked it, and I think the whole band licked it, and we had it, you know, suck us off, and, you know, all stuff that guys do to each other, whether you're, you know, dying of cancer or not. So we took some great pictures of that. So then there was some pictures of that up at Daniel's funeral, and then the eulogy by the minister was exactly as expected. Spoke of the incredible person that Daniel was, and Daniel's sister was wearing a shirt that said, "I knew Daniel House before he was famous." Because obviously he became famous from being my friend. As you know, wow, how famous could that be? Like, seven people knew him. If you know, if you're being famous because you're my friend, because I ain't that famous to begin with. So you know, you're really clinging to it. But then this is great as well. So Gareth said a few words about Daniel and kind of put over the fact that he loved wrestling and the fact that he was on an online wrestling forum called TPWW.net. Back in the days before Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, there were online forums where like-minded people could come together and discuss just about anything wrestling. And it was more than just a text on a screen. It was a community, and Dan was part of that community. And we thank all of the people on TPWW.net who supported Daniel over the last few months of his life and supported his love of wrestling. But then Gareth continues, "We weren't talking just about who the tag team champions really should be. And all this other stuff. We talk about life. We've seen marriages and divorces on there. We've seen births and sadly deaths." And Gareth had asked some people on that forum, TPWW.net, to share some personal stories about Dan. He got hundreds. One in particular stuck out, an American guy called Heisenberg, which is probably an alias. If not, he's got the coolest name of all time. An Iraq veteran who'd been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic syndrome, I believe, and told how he struggled to adjust to civilian life. He said his conversations with Dan and Dan's openness about his cancer really helped him deal with his own problems. He actually said talking to Dan was better than the drugs that the Veteran Affairs prescribed him. One of the examples of the way that Daniel connected and changed people's lives. guys. And that was Daniel House. Very, very cool, open guy about his cancer. Would discuss it and say, listen, man, we're all going to be in the same boat someday, and this is how I'm fighting it. And just because I have cancer doesn't mean I'm not going to live the rest of my life. And he definitely did. So just continuing on, the talked about how Dan became famous from doing Talk is Jericho, and how an interview with Dan on my show made people all over the world aware of what Dan was going through with his battle with cancer, the incredible person he is, but also how they could kind of relate that to their own lives. Talked about how Dan proposed to Michaela in a wrestling ring in front of over 12,000 people, which was an amazing night in Melbourne, Australia, something I'll never forget. I was able to help organize that. And thanks to Triple H and Michael Hayes for giving the green light to that, because they're the ones that I had to ask. I didn't just say, sure, you can propose. I said, I'll ask. And I asked Michael Hayes and I asked Triple H, and they both agreed to it. So thanks for that. Thanks for Justin Roberts, too. He was really, really good to those guys sitting in the front row. So Daniel House was an inspiration to all of us. And then Daniel's daughter, Shekiah, wrote some beautiful words about her dad that a family friend wrote. Wasn't a dry eye in the house, so it's a kind of a sad thing, but here's where it gets fun. We placed Daniel's coffin in the hearse and made the short, slow, cold walk to the cemetery in Tasmania, where he was to be buried. When we got there, as we took the coffin from out of the hearse, the divinal song, I Touch Myself, came blaring from the gravesite, a karaoke staple for Dan, and all six of the pallbearers cracked up. That's pretty funny. You're about ready to go into the grave, and I Touch Myself is played. That's requested by you, right? Then we placed Dan's coffin at the grave, and before a prayer from the minister, the sounds of Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, John Cleese could be heard, Monty Python. There was more than one confused look on the many faces, but for me and Dan's other close friends, always look on the bright side of life was a perfect master stroke. So we're hearing I Touch Myself followed by always look on the bright side of life, and he's dead. That's very Monty Python-esque. Then a minister read a poem and a prayer. And then as they were standing by the gravesite, they placed the flowers on Dan's coffin, and they had a bunch of balloons in Y2J colors. And then the Y2J countdown started, and when it hit zero, the balloons were released to the sky, and the coffin started lowering into the ground. I mean, that is pretty cool, you know? Brings a little tear to mine and makes me laugh. It's like, what a great way for the countdown to signify going down to the grave. So that kind of sums up Daniel's life, you know, taking the piss out of himself and saying, hey guys, it ain't all that bad. And man, I mean, you know, what a horrible thing Daniel went through, but I'm actually a little bit envious of him that he got to plan such a cool ass funeral. And it's one of those things, I'm pretty glad I got to hear about that. You know, I couldn't have made it there, and I didn't really, it's one of those things where I would have liked to have gone, but Tasmania is a long way away. And my relationship with Daniel was very much between us. A lot of things were said that no one else ever did. So I kind of wanted to keep it that way. But I'm glad that I heard about that. And I'm glad that he used my countdown and my music to go into the grave site. So, yeah, that shows you right there what kind of a guy Daniel House was and why I keep talking about him. I mean, all of us have people that we lose. And I just really put a big impression on my life. And I hope you guys understand the reason why. So say a little prayer for Daniel House and for his family. And if you want to hear a really inspirational story, go check him out on Talk is Jericho from about a year ago on YouTube. And in honor of Daniel House, we're going to play the song that he had going when they showed the pictures of us licking his distended, photographed face. SOS by Fozzy for one of the coolest Fozzy fans I've ever met in my life, and a good friend of mine. This one's for you, Daniel.
Where are those happy days? They seem so hard to find. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice, it used to be so good.
Time to go home.
so far away, though you were standing near. You made me feel alive, but something died, I fear. I really tried to make it out. I wish I understood what happened to our love. It used to be so good.
A good little cry, thinking about people that have gone through our lives and left a pretty good impression. And definitely Daniel is one of those guys. And you're speaking to people who left a good impression. I'm going to have a great guy on that left an impression on me as a kid when I watched him play hockey, and has left a great impression on him since I got to meet him as an adult. I'm talking about Bobby Hull, one of the greatest hockey players of all time, the greatest Chicago Blackhawk player, one of the greatest Winnipeg Jets, and an amazing, amazing guy. So many cool stories. And Bobby, you know, he's looking pretty good. He's getting up there, but he still looks like he can strap on a pair of skates and beat your ass if you wanted to. Right, sitting across from me, one of the greatest of all time, Bobby Hull, the Golden Jet. It's really cool to be sitting with you, Bobby.
Chris, can't tell you. Of course, we go back, your father.
That's right,
we
yeah.
We played against one another for many years.
Uh-huh.
And very, very great times playing against your dad. And on my way out of Winnipeg yesterday, coming back to Chicago, there a couple of the midget wrestlers. Oh, they're the cutest little thing. And I remember going to see them, Sky Low Low and yeah. Little Beaver and
right.
And the whole bunch of them. And it was just fun to be with them. And it's great to be with you.
Well, you know, it, a couple things. Well, first of all, since you mentioned that, because you played in Winnipeg in the 70s, and obviously we'll talk about all this, but wrestling was really popular in Winnipeg, the AWA out of Minneapolis.
The greatest, biggest bar on Sunday nights in the world is Winnipeg Arena. When they had wrestling.
Yeah.
They'd fill the joint and it was.
Did you ever something. Have any experiences with any of those guys coming through town or being there at the same time?
Just my son, when I'd take them, he'd Bart, my, what is it, Bobby Blake. Brett and Bart, fourth one, I guess, or fifth one.
One of them.
And he was there, and when somebody got smart with him, and he drilled. He's a bad little. He just drilled the wrestler, and the kid laughed. And
I remember one time, like, there was always a little bit of a correlation between wrestling and the Jets, because it's Winnipeg, like you said, the arena.
Sure.
And there was a match one time in a cage, and they had John Ferguson was the guest referee. I still remember that for the world title.
They should have taken him and popped that pimple on the top of his shoulders. I wouldn't have had to do it a long time.
That's right. But it was so funny. I'll never forget the time I went to my brother-in-law's mother's house for Easter. And I walked in the door and I looked in the corner and I said to my
is that Bobby Hall in the corner? She's like, oh, yeah, he's married to Brant's mom's sister. And I was like, you got to be warning me about this stuff. Like, because we never actually, if we met, it was when I was a kid, but we never actually met as an adult.
No.
And I flipped out. I was like, fucking Bobby Hall's in the corner. What are you? Why didn't you tell me this?
Well, you had your twins there.
And, I did, and my son. Yeah.
I enjoyed that very much.
But it was funny because it was just this random Easter thing. I had no idea. No one had ever told
Thanksgiving.
Me.
It was Thanksgiving. Yeah, that's it wasn't right. Easter. It was Easter this year, I think.
Okay, yeah. I saw your wife there.
Yeah, she was there then.
But you had the best line ever. The kids got so many toys. You said, look at all these toys. When I was a kid, if I didn't wake up with a heart on, I had nothing to play with all day.
That's an outtake, folks.
I called my dad. I said, you got your Bobby's joke. This is great. But we're here in Chicago, and we talked a little bit about you went to the game last night. You still have a pretty big presence in Chicago as kind of like the ambassador for the Blackhawks.
It's amazing after all those years. And I hit my last year in Chicago was 71, 72. Mm-hmm. But going back there, it's just like going back home. So many people that are hockey fans now and that have the affluence to go to games, they were at the games when I played. Hmm. And they remembered the great teams that we had and how well we entertained them. Mm-hmm. All the while I was in Chicago, I broke in 57 and left in 72. And they were 15 of the greatest years of my life. The prime of my life playing there in Chicago. So they remember the great teams we had with the Makitas and the Pierre Pilots and the Dennis Hulls and et cetera, Chico Mackeys and all the rest of them.
When did you kind of come back in the fold into Chicago again?
Chris, I never ever thought that I'd ever be back in Chicago. I thought I'd burnt all the bridges that I possibly could in leaving Chicago. Mm-hmm. But when Rocky Wirtz took over, he was not cut from the same bolt of cloth that his father and grandfather
Bill
were.
Bill Wirtz.
Dollar Bill Wirtz and old Arthur Wirtz. He is a magnificent person. Just a fabulous guy. And you couldn't want to work for a nicer person. Mm-hmm. And he did everything that the people in Chicago wanted him to do, and all of a sudden here are four or 5,000 people in the building. And when he took over, he put the home games on TV. He got rid of the deadwood in Bob Pulford and all that regime that were doing nothing but destroying in Chicago. And then hired John McDonough and his group from the Cubs, likely the greatest sports marketing people I've ever come in contact with. And Scotty Bowman that brought him on to help his son out. And I think the icing on the cake was when they hired Stan Mikita and yours truly to be ambassadors. They said, this guy is doing what we've been looking to have done for the past 35 years. Yeah. And in so doing, they just flocked back to the rink and 22,000 people at the games.
Amazing.
It's a
big rink, too.
It is a big rink. Nice rink, too. Not like the old Chicago stadium. Not quite as noisy. they try to make it that way, but it's not as noisy.
My dad tells me the story about how, I believe it was Chicago, might have been Boston, I think it was Chicago, where the dressing rooms were downstairs.
22 steps, Chris.
In your skates.
Oh, yeah.
And he said you'd walk up the steps and you'd hear this click, click.
Oh, yeah.
Roar as he came up, and then people would just be like, the Rangers, Mm-hmm. I mean, that's because Chicago is such a great sports town. It's like New York.
Well, just think of it. They support two baseball teams, mm-hmm. National and American League, Cubs and the White Sox.
Right.
Basketball team, mm-hmm. the Bulls, the Bears, mm-hmm. NFL, two hockey teams.
Right.
And anyone else that wants to come into that area, they'll support them.
Yeah.
They're just wonderful sports fans, and they love their sports. They love hockey. Hockey was, back in the 60s, was the toughest ticket.
Why is that?
That you could get.
Oh, just to buy one?
Just to buy one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is so crazy.
They couldn't get it. Yeah.
Well, when you talk, like if you go even into the WWE locker room, you know, and ask, what's your favorite crowd? I will always say, and so will 90% of the guys, Chicago.
Oh,
the
sure.
crowd is always the loudest yeah. and most boisterous, yep. and mm-hmm. it's like that for hockey as well.
They appreciate you. They appreciate you know? Everything you do for them.
Yeah.
And if you want to try something out, take it to Chicago. They'll let you know how whether they like it or if they don't.
Yeah. When you're watching the games now, I mean, obviously, the times change. You know, the style of play changes. But you were such a pioneer back in your when you were, you know, in the 60s and all that sort of thing. What are some of the differences that you see between the team now and the style of play now in comparison to when you were?
Well, the kids today are bigger mm-hmm. and faster, mm-hmm. skate faster and shoot harder, but they don't play for the same reason that we played. I always say I played for likely five reasons. To make a boyhood dream come true to play in the National Hockey League, as most all red-blooded Canadians did. Your father was no yeah. different. To entertain the people royally, and I think that we did that. To work up a thirst so we could drink some beer and chase some girls. So now what's wrong with that that menu? but the equipment is so much better now. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid if I had the skates that they wear today, I'd be out on Madison Street more often. I'd be out with the Zamboni and the sticks, all those composite sticks. I don't know how hard we could have shot the puck.
So you're saying with your stick being made of wood?
Yep.
That gave you a harder shot.
No, the composites now.
Oh.
The puck just flies off.
Oh, you would have had, would have had even a harder shot.
Oh, God.
And been a faster skater.
Oh, would have been either top corner or second balcony.
And no control over each,
none,
right?
None whatsoever.
How about as far as the style of play with the toughness, hitting and that sort of thing?
I think that we had more hitting. I believe we controlled the puck more, and we did it for we did things for a reason. Mm-hmm. I know when I played, I waited for everyone to go up the ice, and then I would come with speed from behind. And when I would reach the other opposition blue line, everyone was standing around in there, and I was going at 25 or 30 miles an hour, and they couldn't touch me. Because I was...
You had the head of steam built
yeah,
up.
Yeah, they were standing still. Mm-hmm. And once your feet stop, your brain stops. So I'd get the puck and be able to waltz through a maze of players and then be able to blister the puck at the net. They go up five racing this way, five back this way, or ten, I should say. Mm-hmm. They're in mass, just like you take your hand and your right hand and into your left hand. That's how they'd race up the ice, race. Mm. And I told Brett Hull, I said, Brett, I said, the further you are from that puck, the more you're in the play. And he used to say, Dad, what the hell are you talking about? Mm-hmm. And after he got the idea, and I've heard him on the interview, he said, my dad used to tell me, the further I was from the puck, the more I was in the play. And I used to think, what is wrong with that father of mine? But I found out what he meant. He meant stay away from the people and then go into the spot that's open and the puck will come to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
With some speed, too. Yeah.
Well, no one could release the puck like Brett Hull could. No one could score goals in so many different ways as Brett Hull could. Yeah. And not just because he was my boy. He's fabulous. He's like you were to Ted.
But you know what's amazing? You know, you see this, you talk about genetics. Dad looks like son. Same hair or same, you know, laugh. Even in wrestling, some guys will take, a slam the same way. But Brett Hull's wrist shot came straight from Bobby Hull's wrist shot. It's amazing the genetics there.
When we were in Winnipeg, he came to every practice pretty well that we had, especially on the weekends, of course. And we'd have our shooting after the practice was over. We had a shooting practice where it was get it and shoot it. Mm-hmm. Don't bite your initials in the puck. When the puck hits your blade, release it. And Brett used to stand there and watch us. And there were only two of us, maybe, that could shoot the puck. Get it and shoot it. any better than Brett Hull when he was just a 10, 11-year-old. He could get that puck and just wire it. Mm-hmm. And he learned a lot from watching. He was a quick learn, quick study, and knew the mechanics of shooting the puck. Mm-hmm. And didn't use a stick that he couldn't overpower. He overpowered the stick. And with that, by that, I mean, Chris, he could compress it. And it's just like a golf club. If you can't compress a golf club handle, it's not going to knock the ball that 300 yards like you want it to.
Right.
You have to be able to compress it so that that club head whips back into shape once you come down through the swing.
Oh.
Same with hockey. When Brett Hull would lay on that stick, if you ever saw pictures of him, it was just like a bow. And then when he'd release it, all the genetics generated in that stick would let loose, and just the puck would just jettison off the blade.
Was that your technique as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because I
shot the puck much, or Brett, maybe I should say, shot the puck much the same way I did.
But let me ask you this. I mean, and I don't know specifically, but I'd always heard, even from my dad, I'm looking at your wrists right now. He said, Bobby, all of these big wrists, and was kind of one of the pioneers of the wrist shot,
yeah.
Which means, for people that don't know, slap shot is the stick goes up above your shoulders and you bring it through. Wrist shot, you don't even move your arms. You're just basically using your wrist.
You pull it.
Yeah.
Pull it in and then pop it.
Did you, I'm not going to say did you invent it, but did you make that a popular move?
Well, Chris, when I played, I didn't make any bones about it. I couldn't stick handle past my grandmother. But I could skate. Mm-hmm. I was in good shape always and could shoot the puck. Mm-hmm. So I thought to myself, if I could put myself in a position to shoot the puck, that's what I have to do. So I skated well. I worked out. I was in great shape and would put myself in a position to fire the puck. And That's all. That's all I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, put myself in a position, and all my teammates knew, I'm not giving you this puck to get an assist. I'm giving you this puck so you get it back to me in better shape, so I can shoot it.
Right.
I was no fool.
Yeah.
No fools in our
assists,
family.
Yeah. Right. I'm the artillery man.
Like my dad says, anybody can get an assist.
Well, I mean, and another thing. That's interesting, too, is in those days nobody wore helmets and goaltenders didn't wear masks. I had heard because your shot was so hard, that's why guys started saying, we better put something on our face.
Well, actually speaking, I don't know who it was that got cut. And I think it was Freddie Stanfield, who played for Boston, used to be with us. He was in that terrible trade, Esposito's Hodge and Stanfield to Boston for search and destroy Marat and seek out and eliminate a goaltender by the name of Jack Norris and Pitiful Pit Martin. It was the worst trade in the history. And he had a straight stick, mm-hmm. and he hit the goaltender. But they had one excuse to limit the curve on our sticks. And I think, revolutionized the game with the hook sticks. Mm-hmm. When we got so we could use it properly, but they just wanted to govern us and.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with the idea of a curved stick? First of all, Jules Marat put me in a garbage can when I was 5 years old in the St. Louis Blues dressing room. And I think he gave me a cigarette too. No, that was Bobby Plager gave me a cigarette.
So. That would be more like it.
Yeah, but I mean, you're talking about the curved stick, and I know this is you and Makita pretty much invented this. Where did you come up with the idea?
Well, Stan was an awful bugger. He hated Northland sticks, the old wooden sticks. And every time he'd get one that he didn't like, he'd lean on it and break it. Mm-hmm. And I said, Stan, I know 400 little guys that would love to have your stick. If you don't like it, put it on my rack and I'll see that a deserving kid gets your stick. Screw those little practices. And then he'd just lean on it and break it. Well, this day at practice, Billy Ray was working with the also-rans, and Makita and I are at center ice, John. And he gets on the stick again. these GD Northlands. I hate them. So he's leaning on it, trying to break it. And he's only 165 pounds soaking wet, and he couldn't break the stick. The stick was too lithe and willowy, and he couldn't break it by leaning on it. So he went over to the door of our bench and jammed the stick in the door and then tried to break it that way. Well, what happened? The bottom part of the blade stayed in the door, and it split down the middle, and the top part flew out. So it came out about the width of a puck. And I don't know whether you played road hockey to the point where your stick would get thin.
Mm-hmm.
When you'd go out and play on the ice with it, you could really shoot the puck because there was no resistance there. It was the same width as your stick. And he kept trying to break it, and he came out with a heck of a wow in the bottom of the blade, like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a combination of course, being thin and with the hook. Now he's got to get a new stick, so the deal was we didn't even know enough to bring an extra stick up with us up those 22 steps. And he'd pound on the glass. Trainer would come, see who it was, go back down, get a stick, another stick off a rack, bring it up. Well, while the trainer was looking and going back to get him a stick, there were some pucks laying in the net. And here he is over there pulling these pucks out of the net and snapping them back in the net, pulling them out in the net. And I'm thinking to myself, I said, Makita's gone completely bonkers. Look at what he's doing, fishing those pucks out of the net, shooting them back in, fishing them out, shooting them back in. So he came over to me. I said, what the hell were you doing down there, taking those pucks out of the net and then firing them back in? He said, well, Bobby, when I tried to break my stick, I put a hell of a wow in the blade. And can you ever shoot the puck with that hook in the blade? I said, well, it's a combination, of course, of the thinness and the hook.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, after the practice, I'm going to call Northland and have him send me a half a dozen with a hook in the blade. I said, well, while you're at it, just tell him to send me a half a dozen, only hook him the other way, because he shot right and I shot left.
Yeah.
And it went from there to, we didn't know how. We didn't have the torch back then.
How do you bend that? You have to burn it almost and bend it while it's...
Almost, yeah. You heat the blade on both sides.
So
and then
it's rubbery?
And then step on it and hook it the way you want. Well, the only way I could figure out to do that was run it under the hot water tap until it got soft.
Hmm.
And then we'd put it under a door and jack it up and put a chair, the back of a chair, under the stick so that it was all night like this.
So
and then when
it.
When you come down in the morning, it was, that's like I said, it was either top corner or second balcony. those sticks were just, some of them almost a half circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you tell anybody that you were using these sticks? Or just
everybody saw it.
You could see it.
They could see it, yeah.
So
yeah.
Did somebody rat you out? Or I'm sure somebody...
Of course, yeah. All the sports writers and the telecasters said, oh, there's Makita and Hull out there with those hook sticks again.
So did they make you... What did the league...
1970, I believe, was 1970. They appointed a guy by the name of Dutch Van Dielen, who never did one GD thing to promote the game of hockey. They promoted he and his group to police before every playoff game. The sticks, you had to have three sticks ready for the games. So, of course, sticks were there in the rack. They'd put their initial on it, that they were okay. As soon as their backs were turned, out came the torch, and I'd crank her up the way I wanted it. So they never really ever took my stick, because they knew I'd make an ass of them if they ever did.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, you had such a powerful wrist shot with or without the stick, even.
I scored 50 goals with a straight stick back in 1962,
when
we started the hook in 63. So...
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you pretty much already set the tone of what you were doing.
Yeah.
Did you have a shot that would raise off the ice? Like I mentioned earlier, we were talking about goaltenders that had no mask. Were you zinging shots top corner or second balcony? Were the goalies scared of you?
Well, A lot of them were. And you talk about goaltenders playing without a mask. Our goaltender, Glenn Hall, who had come from Detroit before, played over five. Now, think about this, Chris, and your fans. Think about this. Glenn Hall played over 500 consecutive games without a mask.
And, consecutive.
And had to face Dennis and I in practice. But I knew when Glenn didn't want to stop the puck, he'd just get over to one side of the net and I'd shoot it in the other side. Mm-hmm. Not Dennis. Dennis, Glenn would get it in one side of the net and Dennis would hit him over there. Then he'd get outside the net and Dennis would chase him. And I remember Glenn, he talked with a little Lithuanian. He, Billy, those Hull boy, they're shooting at me again. But we knew. I always practiced on the practice goaltender, or the second,
rather than
Glenn Hall. When he and Tony, if they didn't want to take the shots, they used to just get one side of the net, and I'd shoot it in the other side.
Yeah, it's practice.
Of course, this is practice for them as much as anything. And that's what I get a lot of guys in warm-ups. I see them going in there and wiring them right under the crossbar on their starting goaltenders. I said, come on, guys.
Right.
These guys are warming. This is their warm-up.
Yeah, you want to shoot it on the pads and in the glove. I'd
take one stride and shoot it and bounce it off their pads or give them something to catch from 50 feet out.
Right, yeah.
So these guys go in there and wire it right up around their ears.
Yeah, you scored a goal in the warm-up. Good for you.
You know what we call those guys?
What?
Morning glories. You'd see these guys, they could skate and they could shoot big and strong. In the morning, they look like world beaters. Come the night of the game, you have to get a program to find out who the hell they were. We call them morning glories.
Morning glories.
Talk is Jericho.
Sitting across from me, one of the greatest of all time, Bobby Hull. Who were some of the goaltenders that you, I guess the best guys that you played against?
Eddie Giacomo was deathly afraid of both Dennis and I.
Really?
Oh, yeah. All I'd have to do is drop my shoulder and he'd be right up on his
You could fake him out.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I knew the size of every goaltender's skate. Oh, there's a 9.5, there's an 11, there's a 12. They go right up in their heels.
Oh, like Flamingo you.
Yeah. Right up in their heels, and then they could do whatever you wanted with them. You had them.
Was there anybody that, because you were a fast skater too, he's talking about defensemen, were there some guys that could stop you?
Oh, hell yeah. Everyone out there could stop you. And back then, Chris, think about this. I played for 10 years in the original six. Mm-hmm. And we played against one another 15 times this.
Right.
14 times. What would it be? 14 times a year.
Five, yeah. 70 games.
Yeah. 70. Yeah, that's what we played, 70. And you had to make a hell of a play because you were playing against the same people night in and night out.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the, as I said, I used to come from behind with speed. I never forced the play up. I didn't want to be up front. I wanted to come from behind.
So, how hard was it to get in the league back in those days? You're talking about those six teams with 15 players on a roster.
Yeah. She was, well, about 20.
Okay,
about
20.
20 players on
she
the roster.
She did with 120, 140 players.
Six times 20, 120,
yeah,
120 players are the best, supposedly the best.
Yeah.
And once it was one thing to make it, but then to stay there was another thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't hustle your rear end every game, every shift, there was always three or four guys in the minors that wanted to take your place. And that's why we played guilty. We played guilty all the time, but we played hurt a lot because we didn't want anyone else to take our jobs.
Take your spot.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, if you got sent down to the minors, it was hard to get sent back up.
I should say. Yeah, once they started to tool with you in the minors, you very seldom got another go.
Was there ever any players that you were with that you knew, like, man, that guy could have made it or should have made it, but
there were likely a half a dozen on everyone's roster that were interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
You could wouldn't matter if they were up, that group was up, or the next group was up, because they were that back end of our people. I say there were, I think they had 18 players and two goaltenders. Those bottom three or four guys were interchangeable.
Okay.
They were the same talent, and it was just whether the general manager liked you, or did not like you.
It's politics at that point.
Of course it was politics.
You could be blackballed just because you rubbed them the wrong way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did that ever happen that you would see? Like,
I've seen people that drank themselves out of the league, so to speak.
How did you get into the league? Like, it's a different world back then.
I was like every other red-blooded Canadian, Chris. I dreamed about playing in the National League. I can't remember when I didn't. I was either going to get old enough or big enough, and I was going to play in the National Hockey League. And I just dreamed about it and made the boyhood dream come true, as I said earlier. And it was.
But did you play like club hockey or?
We played minor hockey. There were, when I was 10, the nearest town to us, 7 miles away, was Belleville, Ontario.
Where did you grow up?
Southeastern Ontario.
Okay.
About 120 miles east of Toronto, for the people that know a little bit of geography in Canada.
Yeah.
And played minor hockey. And when I was 10, I played Bantam hockey. That was the lowest group that they brought in. And played two or three years Bantam and 1 year of midget when I was still Bantam age.
Mm-hmm.
So I played two years of Bantam, 1 year of midget, and then went away from home when I was 14 to play junior hockey. And that was to a team that the Chicago Blackhawks had sponsored some of the money to run the junior teams.
So you were kind of scouted by them from the start?
Really scouted first by Detroit, a guy by the name of Red Creighton. I thought I was going to Detroit. Wouldn't that have been nice? How and I playing together.
Who would have worn number 9?
Well, maybe I'd be like Gretzky. I didn't know I was a Hull fan or a Howe fan, and he wore 99. but all of a sudden, Chicago knew, because they had sponsored the junior team in Belleville, that I became their property when I was 13 years of age. I became Chicago property when I was 13. Because every city, every town that the parent clubs, the original six, would sponsor a junior team, the product coming out of that minor hockey system belonged to the parent club. And that's how I became Chicago property.
How old were you when you played your first NHL game?
Oh, I didn't. Chris, I wasn't ready. I was 18. I hadn't really burnt up the OHL at that time, the OHA. So I really wasn't ready. But Chicago, they'd been in the basement so long, and they had a bunch of old cooters there that they needed to get rid of. And they wanted to bring some youth into their game. So that's how I got to be able to play.
Who were the big stars on the Blackhawks when you went up there?
Eddie Litzenberger was the big goal scorer. Glenn Hall was our goaltender. Mm-hmm. Teddy Lindsay had come from Detroit. Todd Sloan had come from Toronto Maple Leafs. Makita was just a kid coming up. He was 2 years after me. We didn't have too many real good ones. But we got out of the basement on the first year, and then into third place in the third year, and then from there she was all downhill.
Because you said you weren't ready though when you first came up. Do you remember your first game? Were you scared? Were you nervous?
Of course I was nervous. But I can't remember the first.
Yeah.
I can remember my first goal.
Oh, yeah?
I wheeled into the goal area with the puck and got checked into the goaltender, and I took the puck and the goaltender to the back of the net. It wasn't a thing of beauty, but there were a lot of things of beauty after that.
Yeah. That counted, though, if you scored with the goaltender and the puck?
Looked like the line score, like looked like a line drive in the box score.
But like you mentioned, you helped turn Chicago's fortunes around. You guys won a Stanley Cup. I know that was the first one they'd won in years.
1961. 1940, I think, was before that sometime, 43 or something.
Right, and you said they were in the basement this whole time. Yep. You're scoring 50 goals in a season, which hadn't been done. If it had been done, it hadn't been done many times.
Two other guys had scored 50 goals in a season. Mm-hmm. The great Rocket Richard with the Montreal Canadiens scored 50 in 50 games in 1945 when everyone was in the service. And then 1961, Bernie Jeffron, same club.
Boom, boom.
Scored 50 goals. Okay. And then I followed it up in 1962 by scoring 50.
And then scoring more than 50.
I was the first one to break the 50-goal barrier. Yeah, 1966. I scored the 51st. That was the first.
So you're on fire at this point. You're like in the prime of your career.
Oh yeah. We were having fun too. Yeah. You know when you were in your prime, you were having fun.
Absolutely.
I never had a job in my life. I played hockey.
But this is what I kind of wanted to talk to you about. I mean, besides all this other stuff is... In, I think it was probably 70 or 71 or whatever it was, you go to the WHA to become a Winnipeg Jet. Now, mm-hmm. at this point in time, nowadays, free agency, guys go, you know, sometimes, whatever, musicians will go to other record companies or guys will go to different teams, but you jump to this new upstart league. What was the story behind that?
I had just come off a 5-year contract with the Blackhawks. Mm-hmm. And I was 32 years old, and I felt that I had another 5 years of good hockey left in me.
And good hockey for you meaning dominating 50 goals, killing it.
Yeah. Leading the league in scoring. Yeah. And
I'll say it, being one of the best players in the league. I can say that.
Thanks, Chris. Well, apparently they didn't think that I would go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's when 1972, when they were talking, 71, 72, they were talking about starting this new league, this WHA, World Hockey Association. And what they did, they threw all the names of the NHL players that didn't have a contract or had fulfilled their contract. And then they picked out of the hat. I think there were 9 franchises at the beginning of the WHA. So they would pick out of the hat, and whatever name you got, it was up to you to sign them to one of the teams in the WHA.
A piece of paper and a hat.
Yeah, that's the same deal. Wow. Yeah, yep, that's how antiquated it was. Well, it just as it happened, Ben Hatskin picked my name out of the hat with the Winnipeg Jets. Mm-hmm. And they talked about it, and I met Ben first time Grey Cup time in Vancouver, which would be, what is that,
November
something like that. And Bob Turner, who played on our team, had come from Montreal and played on our team in Chicago, worked with Ben, and he said, would you meet a business associate of mine? I said, sure, wait till I go upstairs and get rid of my bag, and we'll go and say hello. And he took me and met and introduced me to Ben Hatskin. Nice guy, gruff, didn't make any bones, made a little bit of small talk, and then said, Bobby, we want you to come be a Winnipeg Jet for $250,000 a year. Well, at that time, I'd just come off a contract, not quite $100,000 with the Blackhawks.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's like one of the top players in the league. About 100 grand or
supposedly,
so.
Supposedly, I don't know. Anyhow, I said, thank you, Mr. Hatskins. That's a very generous offer. But I think I can get 250 from the Blackhawks on a 5-year deal. Mm-hmm. So, anyhow, we've got the rest of this season to play and the playoffs before I want to talk about any other mm-hmm. team. Well, they just kept on me and on me and on me. And my accountant said, they want to know what it'll take to get you to come to the WHA. I said, Harvey, I said, I don't want to leave Chicago. It's the greatest city in the world with the greatest sports fans in the world. Why would I want to lug five kids and an extravagant wife all the way across the country to a place I'd never been before? I'd never been to Winnipeg before. Of course, that's hometown. Was it not? Your dad was...
Yeah, that's where I grew up. That's where you grew up. Yeah, sure. Absolutely, yeah.
And there was nothing... It wasn't Winnipeg. It wasn't... It was just, I didn't want to leave Chicago. So finally, they talked me and they said, well, tell them something so we can get rid of them. I said, okay. So this is how I generalize. I wanted five more years. And I said, if I play 1 year, I'll get my $250,000, but maybe the legal fold. And then I'll be owed $1 million. Mm-hmm. And I don't want Ben Haskin. I like Ben Haskin. I don't want him to be holding to me because I'd sign a personal service contract. I didn't want him to be to pay me $1 million for nothing if the league folded. And I said, and I wouldn't want to go back to the NHL. So I told him, I said, go tell them if they give me $1 million up front, they've got themselves a player. Ha ha. Well, he went, and I said, well, what'd they say? He said, don't do anything until we hear from you. I said, you mean to say they're going to try to raise $1 million for this cowboy? I said, don't be surprised, Bobby. There are nine of them, and all they had to, nine franchises, all they had to do was come up with $100,000. All they had to do,
right?
They had to come up with $110,000.
So they were raising it as a league.
As the league. They knew it. Yeah, that would be a bonus.
For every
from
team.
The league mm-hmm. to me, not Winnipeg,
right?
Not Winnipeg
from the WHA.
No, Winnipeg. If I signed with the WHA with Winnipeg Jets, they owed me $250,000 a year
mm-hmm.
because
for five years,
and then the million was a bonus mm-hmm. for me to jump from the Chicago Blackhawks in the National Hockey League to the WHA.
Wow!
And I said, you mean to say they're, don't be surprised. They called in a week. They had 500,000. They called in another couple of days and had 750,000. I said to my accountant, I said, I'm gone. I said, if Ben Haskin only has $250,000 to make that $1 million, he's going to do it come hell or high water.
Yeah.
I said, I'm a Winnipeg Jet. And I had not had no contract, nothing. It was just a word of mouth.
Wow. Handshake deal, basically.
Yep. And they called and said, we've got you $1 million. I said, you've got yourself a hockey player.
Wow.
That's how it happened.
Did it concern you or worry you that you're going to this brand new upstart league, like you said?
It didn't worry me, Chris, because I knew that I had the ability to carry a team
mm-hmm.
to be a part of a pretty good league. And it looked like there were going to be a lot of guys. Once I signed, a lot of guys were going to jump to the WHA because they were offering them three times the salaries that they were making in.
Where do they get this money? Where do they get that capital from?
Well, they had businessmen that were mm-hmm. in other businesses that they'd made the money, and sure as hell wasn't in hockey. But they had the money that they'd made and came up with it.
Because when you signed, like I'll tell you from my dad's standpoint, he always says, you know, the modern day player owes Bobby Hull because he was making, I think, like, let's say $30,000 a year and went up to 100 because they didn't want anyone else to jump.
That's right. And they gave New York was the team that went to all their players before the league had really got started and gave them all about a three time the amount of raise.
And my dad, was one of them.
Yeah.
How was it for you going to Wirtz or whoever and saying, hey, I'm going to the WHA?
Well, I met them in court. From then, they tried to enjoin me from playing for another league because they thought that the clause in our NHL contract, once you sign one, you belong to that team forever.
Because that's the way it was up until then.
Yeah, Kurt Flood, he countered it in the professional baseball late. So it had gone before us, and we fortunately got a judge down in Philadelphia, Judge Higginbotham. And very fortunate, he was a black judge. And when he came down to his summation, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, nobody owns nobody." And I said, as soon as he said that, I said, "We got him."
Wow.
He said, there was a president of the United States that said nobody owns nobody. Of course, he was speaking of the slaves.
Lincoln and everything, right, exactly.
Yeah. So that's where I met the Blackhawks the next few months in court.
Because you were blackballed.
Oh, of course I was.
Right? Like you were persona non grata to the NHL.
1972 was the summit series against the
Russians.
They barred me from playing there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anything else. They barred my kids. The only one that didn't bother was Brett.
Barring him from playing in the league, you mean?
Yeah. Okay. Or for drafting him or anything like that.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I had Phil Esposito on this show. And we talked at length of that, and he, to this day, was still like, it was bullshit because it was Team Canada versus Team Russia. It wasn't Team NHL. And to not have Bobby Hull and Team Canada was ridiculously stupid.
So it was Team NHL, right. Not Team Canada.
Right.
Of course not.
And they're like, we could have used him.
Christ, I'm Canadian through and through,
right.
And I'm going from an American city, Chicago, to a Canadian city.
Right.
If that is representing Canada.
Yeah. But it wasn't the players that were pissed. It was the owners.
You know? See, it's easy to say, but I know had I been in the position that, let's say, a Phil Esposito was, I would have gathered up our guys and said, hey, if they're not going to let Phil Esposito play, then none of us will play.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And that's how to go about this.
Kind of boycott.
And you not likely knew this, Chris, or a lot of other people. The series against the Russians came from the WHA. We were going to do it, and they got wind of it. But we didn't think we were ready in 1972. Mm-hmm. We were going to do it in the next year or two. And that G.D. Eagleson got word of it, and they went ahead and stole our idea. Stole our idea. Then we played against them in 74.
Okay. Because a lot of those games were actually in Winnipeg. Two of them in 72, right?
One of them in 72 and one in 74.
In 74. Yeah. How was it going to Winnipeg? I mean, there's the famous picture of Bobby Hull at the corner of Portage and Maine.
Oh, Jesus.
Everyone's just going nuts.
Yeah. I know when I went in there into my hotel room, there was a great big leather mouton coat that Ben Hanskin had bought me. He said, "You're going to need that this winter." Of course, I'd never been there before. Chris.
Right, as you said.
I didn't know the winters.
The prairie winters.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, even growing up in Ontario, it's not the same.
Oh, not at all. Yeah. But that year, 72, 73, it was a cakewalk. It was a mild open winter.
Oh, okay.
And I said, what the hell are they talking about? The winters being so rough here in Manitoba. Yeah. But the next year I found out it flooded and the whole thing. And it was a mess.
The Jets were one of the first. WHA as a whole was kind of the first league to bring in a lot of European players.
Toronto had brought Salming and Hammerstrong over the year before. 70, 71 or somewhere in there. They were the first Swedes that I can recall being brought over. But we were the team that brought them over in mass. We brought Ulfie Nilsson, Anders Hedberg, Lars-Erik Schuberg, Danny LeBrotten, Willie Lindstrom, Kurt Larson, Mats Lind, and two Finns by the name of Veli Pekka Ketola and Heksi Ruoranta. And so we had a combination of Swedes and Finns that almost was half our team.
Yeah, the lion's share of the team.
And so we were the first real team, the first professional team to bring any number of Europeans over at one time. And then we got Tommy Bergman after that, who had played in Detroit.
I remember that, yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, the big line was the hotline. Hall, well, Anders, Hedberg, and Ulf Nielsen.
And, Chris, what a joy it was to play with those kids. Oh, they were fabulous. Just, and with little Lars Eric, our little captain.
He
was a general out there, and... Boy, it was fun.
When I was a kid reading his hockey card, I thought his name was Sojberg.
Yeah.
I didn't know how you pronounced it. Lars Eric Sojberg.
S-J-O-B-E-R-G.
Yeah. What?
Yeah. And unfortunately, we lost him. He had stomach problems.
He passed away, yeah. But what a line, the hotline. I mean, that was like growing up, it's funny because there's a couple other guys that I know that you know. You went ice fishing with a guy called Brent Fitz. He's a drummer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Brent and I and everybody from our generation, if you grew up in Winnipeg in the 70s, it was all about the Jets, the hotline, and Bobby Hull.
Sure.
What an amazing, flying, fast line you guys had.
Well, when they came over, I said, guys, listen to me clearly. If there's going to be any changing of the way we're playing, I'll do the changing. You guys stay exactly as you are. And I want you to continue that way. And so all I did was just change positions. And I've done it all my life. I was all over the ice like a can of worms when I played. But no one would change positions with me. I know I'd go over on the right side and there Chico Mackey would be standing there along the boards. What are you doing over here? Instead of him going over on the left side.
Right. Everyone had to stay in their spots.
Oh, yeah. 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 But those guys were unbelievable. And skate, the basic fundamentals. I've never seen anyone to this day handle that biscuit at high speeds like Anders Hedberg did and Gwinnon right in front of the goaltender, right at his feet. Drop his shoulder. He was a left-hand shooter playing right side. Drop his shoulder to go left and pull it back onto the backhand and roof it. All in one motion. He was fabulous. And Ulfie Nielsen came to play every... And he was our playmaker.
Yeah.
Ulfie, number 14. He was fabulous. What a great kid he was.
Did you see those guys and say, I want to play in a line with them? Or
Jerry Wilson, Dr. Jerry Wilson, was over there on a sabbatical in Stockholm. And he called one time and said, Bobby, I've got a couple of kids over here that you would just love to play with. I said, Jerry, if they've got good heads and good hearts, get them to hell over here. And if they can any hockey ability at all, get them over here, because I was running thin with the guys that I had. Mm-hmm. And boy, the first time we went down the ice, we were out practicing with the junior team, or the not the junior team, the college team. Uh-huh. And I always fooled with the pucks out in front of the net, and I'm always frigging around. And they were standing in the corner over on the right side. And all of a sudden the coach said, Bobby, you and the Swedes, line rush. Well, I just turned from my back to the other end and swung up to straighten up, going the right way. Those two came out of that corner like they were shot out of a bazooka. And it was just in the net. We rushed, I don't know how many times, never went up the ice that we didn't score. That's the kind of people they were.
They were, yeah.
And I said, oh, there'll be three shooting them in and four fishing them out this year. and that's the way it was.
Was there a big difference between the quality of play, NHL and WHA?
When we started to play exhibition games, mm-hmm. we won 85% of their games against the NHL.
You played in exhibition games against the NHL?
Oh, yeah. Towards the end of, what would that be? Before, what, the 79, they merged.
Right.
So it was couple of years before that.
When they knew there was going to be a merger, or why were they?
Oh, they knew that we weren't going away.
Okay.
See, we had four teams that were very, very good teams. Quebec Nordic, Edmonton,
mm-hmm. New England Whalers.
The Whalers, yeah. And our Jets, club, yeah. And the Jets. And they were four very, very good teams. And that's when I told them, I said, they're going to rape you guys. They're not going to let you into the league with those kind of teams and have the WHA kicking the shit out of NHL.
Right.
I said, they're going to rape you. I said, now is the time to form a real World Hockey Association. We'll get the Czechs, we'll get the Swedes, we'll get the Finns, and the Russians will get so sick of playing amongst themselves that they'll opt into it in a year or two. I said, now you got the hammer. I said, use it. But we were sold down the river, just like always. When they merged, we had a guy that ran our association that sold us down the river.
How did the merger come to pass? Did they buy the WHA, or was the WHA doing bad business?
Well, that's what I said. They sold down the river.
Gotcha.
Everyone, all of the teams from the WHA, ooh, we're getting in the NHL. I said, yeah, you're getting in the NHL with one or two of the players that you had on
that other team. You could keep two of your guys, and the rest went into a draft, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I said, they're going to rape you guys. So those are the four teams that went in, and they did very well for themselves after they got settled around.
Well, they all ended up being last place teams.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. There was a great rivalry set up with Nordique and the Canadiens, Montreal Canadiens.
That's true. Good point.
And
maybe I'm thinking about the Jets.
The
Oilers?
No, the team on the East Coast.
Oh, the Whalers.
Whalers. When I went there to finish my career in 79-80, we went into the playoffs against Montreal. And we had two games. It was best of three, two overtime games with them. We were this close to beating the mighty Montreal Canadiens back in 79-80.
Were you playing with Gordie Howe? Because he was on the Whalers.
Howe was on the Whalers. Davey Keon.
Wow. Good team.
We had a good team. Very
good.
That's
the first time you ever played with Gordie Howe in the same team.
First time other than All-Star games.
Gotcha. Yeah. I was going to ask you earlier, what kind of training did you do? You mentioned that you were training, you're going to get in the league no matter what. Like in the 60s, what were you doing?
70. Well, I trained. I'm a farmer by heart, and I raised cattle, and I threw bales of hay around all summer.
Thing, yeah.
And I was on my feet all year, all summer. The only time that I did any extra training was 76 Canada Cup. That would be the first time that any WHA people were brought to camp to represent Canada in the WHA. Jerry Cheevers, Paul Schmier, and I think myself, there were only three of us. And I said, these guys are going to find any little chink in my armor to give me the bum's rush. So I took the kids would go over with me. There was a third of a mile track at one of the barracks, one of the Air Force barracks or Army barracks here in town. And I'd go over there with Bobby Blake and Brett, and we'd start running, and I'd walk a third, lope a third, and then sprint a third. And of course, Brett was the first one out. He couldn't make it around the first one. And Blake was the next one out, and then Bobby was about 16 then, I guess. And he stayed with me for quite a while. And when I saw him last, he's hollering at me, "You old son of a bitch, you're 37 years old, and you can still outrace me at 60. But that's the only, and I went in really good shape
to the
Canada Cup. We trained in Montreal, and they pulled a fast one on me. Scotty Bowman was a coach, and a number of others. Sam Pollock was there, and Jean Beliveau was there, and Bobby Crom, and they called the trainer, the equipment guy says, "Bobby, the brass, they're gathering in there. They want to see you after you shower." I said, "Uh-oh, here it comes." So I showered up and walked in, and there, Orr was there. Bobby Clark was there. Denny Putnam was there. Bob Gainey, maybe, and all the coaching staff. And I said, "Here it comes." And Scotty Bowman's jingling change in his pocket and looking up the ceiling. He says, "Bobby, we've decided that we're going to have Bobby Clark as our captain, and Bobby Orr and Denny Potvin as assistants. And we were just wondering if you'd like to be one of our assistant captains of the team. Well, they could have bought me for a plug nickel. I thought, here it comes. They're going to give me the bum's rush. And they laughed their ass. They knew what I was thinking. But there was some. That Orr was fabulous. On one leg.
Because his knee was messed up.
Yeah. We were scrimmaging. And it ended up 2-2. Mm-hmm. So Scotty Bowman said, a losing team has to do wind sprints. Now, I'm 37. Bobby's got a bad knee. We looked at one another. He didn't want any more sprints than I did. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. They dropped the puck. And I was playing with Marcel Dion and Gilbert Perrault at that time. And the puck came over to me on the left side, and I wheeled it to Orr on the right point. And he hit, and I circled around. He hit it diagonally down the left wing. I followed him up to the red line, and then I went in the slot area before he went around the net. He laid the puck out to me, and it was behind Rogie Vachon. Well, he kept going this way, and I turned this way. We met at the gate going off the ice.
Yeah.
And I opened the door, and I said, "After you, Mr. Orr." He said, "No, after you, Mr. Hall." and it was one of the greatest moments of my life. But he was better on one leg than most of us on two.
Well, that's what you always hear. It's either Orr or Gretzky, depending on what side of the coin you're on, you know?
Gretzky could. No. Bobby Orr was the best. Next to Brett Hull, Bobby Orr was
the best. There you go. Did you play with Gretzky at all when he was on the Indianapolis, against him when he was on the Indianapolis Racers?
One of my last games in the WHA.
Did you see, wow, this guy's got some special.
Let me tell you a little story about that. I'll tell you how the game went. I scored the winning goal against Suitcase Smith.
Gary Suitcase Smith. Named because he played for so many teams.
Oh, yeah.
He never unpacked his suitcase.
Oh, Christ, no. And so before that, Lars Eric and Anders and Alfie and I are having a cup of tea before we went to the game. And there was this only other person in the restaurant was a lady sitting over by the windows on the one side of them. So we got up to put our jackets on, the player bear bill, and up she gets and heads for us. And she came over and she said, "Are you Mr. Hull?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "My name is Phyllis Gretzky, and you're going to be playing against my son tonight, and I don't want you to hurt him." I said, "Mrs. Gretzky, you don't have to worry about any of our team hurting your son, Wayne. We'll allow him to play his game. That's not our way of playing." And he played like hell that night. He hit the post a couple of times and got madder than hell because he didn't count anything. But he made things happen. And that was the last time, I played against him. But here's another story that a lot of people don't know. When I was finished in 1980, I got a call from Glenn Sather, who was then coach and manager of the
Oilers.
He said, "Bobby, we've got a kid here you'd just love to play with." I said, "Glenn," I said, "I'm right up to my eyeballs with hockey, and I'm down a court, and I've had enough of it." But he says, "I understand." He said, "I'm going to give you a call in a couple of weeks, see if you change your mind. We'd love to have you come here and play with us." Stupidly, all I had to do was go there and lay the stick on the ice. I'd have scored 50.
Oh, yeah.
But I made it.
And what a draw it would have been, man. What a draw it would have been. You know, we're getting ready. That's all right. Is it Gretzky? Is it Sather? Still wants you to come play for him?
That was Sather. Yeah. But my shoulders were gone.
Then. Yeah.
But likely what I had done was have the shoulder looked at it. And just that year, I just snapped something in there. I heard it pop. I had two goals, and I was walking in on another Smith goaltender, and I laid on the stick to pop one. And it was just like, you know, the cork guns that you had as kids with the string on them, and they go pop.
Yeah.
And it sounded like that, or I'd stepped on a light bulb.
Mm.
And, God, what the hell's happened? I looked at my stick. Nothing wrong with my stick. But the next morning, my shoulder was sore as a boil.
So. That was it, yeah.
But all they had to do then was a little, what do they call it?
Orthoscopic surgery. Yeah.
And fixed it. And fixed whatever was wrong with it in there.
Because you're only 40 years old or so, right?
42 at that time. 40-something. Okay. I don't know, something like that.
When you look back, do you think you made the right move still going from NHL to WHA?
There are pros and cons.
Mm-hmm.
Likely had I stayed in Chicago, I'd have got into something that maybe a different business or even with the team. Although going to Winnipeg gave me great deal of satisfaction to bring hockey to a smaller area and give a lot of kids a chance to strut their wares and to become not only great players, but all-stars and Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
We produced, out of the first year of those four teams going into the NHL, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Hartford, and Quebec, out of the top 20 scorers, ten of them were from the WHA.
Yeah,
and of course we had guys like Gretzky in there,
and Messier,
Goulet, Lindsman, Mark Napier. There were some great players came out of the WHA.
Mm-hmm. When they talk about your stats overall in your career now, like when you're in the Hall of Fame, do they count the WHA?
No.
They don't, so it's just the NHL. Yeah. So your stats would have been a lot bigger if you had stayed in the NHL.
Well, likely I would have played until I maybe scored as many as my son. He scored 750, I think.
What did you get?
In 15 years, I got 610.
But see, another thing too, though, Bobby, and we're getting ready to wrap up here, but once again, you started this whole system that the players play in of free agency and just the amount of money they make. That's, if it wasn't for what you had done, things might not be the way they are now.
They'd have been picking shit with the chickens just like they were then.
Yeah, especially in the 70s, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because when you went to, who followed you to the WHA? Sanderson went, Derek Sanderson.
Yeah, but he was no good. He was not a leader.
Right. No. So you were the guy.
Cheevers came.
So there's a couple
he
others.
Played well.
Yeah.
Jerry Pinder, Christian Bordelot, Mark Tardif. A lot of that Whaler team came from the Maple Leafs.
Okay.
Rick Lee and Selwood and a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but that league was basically on your shoulders when you moved.
More or less, I believe that had our team not survived, and I'm talking about the Winnipeg Jets, that the league would have folded.
Yeah,
because we went a couple of paychecks without taking pay.
Yeah.
just so that the team would.
Did you have to rally? Did you have to rally the troops when that happened?
Oh no!
Okay,
Bobby, what are you going to do? I said we're not going to get paid for a couple of three or four weeks. Okay, if you aren't, we're not. They were a great group of guys. Oh,
well, last question: you scored so many great goals. Is there one that stands out in your mind? You're like, that was my favorite.
There were so many, Chris. Once in my third year, once I got to know what I was doing, I won the scoring championship in 1959-60. And once I got to know that I could compete with the Howes and the Beliveaux and the Moores and the Espositos and the Mihaloviches, that was a feather in my cap. And I scored a power of goals in 15 years, 610 of them.
Yeah.
But I guess likely the one that stands out, and it wasn't because it was the goal that broke the 50-goal barrier, scoring 51 for the first time. It was a tremendous ovation that the Chicago fans gave me. They just stood and applauded and applauded.
It was for like 5 minutes or something, right?
They said 12 or 15
minutes. Okay, there you go.
Yeah. And likely that was the one, but... against your dad's team, mm-hmm. 1971, we had a great series, semifinals.
Hawks and Rangers.
Against New York. Oh, they had a great team. We had three overtime games in that series, the seven games.
Oh, yeah.
Pete Stemkowski scored the winning goal in two of those games mm-hmm. in New York. And I scored one against Jockman in Chicago, and we beat him out. That was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and we were a little beat up, and we got an extra day off, and they claim that's the one that New York had a great team, and they thought they should have won it, and we should have gone on and beat the Canadians, for goodness sakes, leading 2-0 going in the third period. Getting the wrong people out there three times. Come on. I still have nightmares about it.
It still bugs you to this day. That's a true warrior, man. Bobby, it's great talking to you, and I'm glad we're able to make this happen
Chris,
today.
Fabulous.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Was a great year. You're well-versed on the game of hockey.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
As well as a tremendous athlete in the wrestling business.
Thank you, sir.
Everybody knows Chris Jericho. That's for sure.
Thanks again to NHL Hall of Famer, one of the greatest of all time, Bobby Hull. The Chicago Blackhawks are taking on the Tampa Bay Lightning. Game one of the NHL Championship starts tonight. Cheer on Bobby's team, the Blackhawks. And don't forget about the Winnipeg Jets. They're coming back huge next year. You wait and see. And coming back huge a week from Friday, my summer run with the WWE, the Y2J WWE Summer Tour. As you guys know, I'm doing live events this summer. No TVs and pay-per-views. I'm only coming to your town, non-televised, starting June 12th in Springfield, Illinois, June 13th, Terre Haute, June 20th, Las Vegas, 27th, Boston, 28th, Reading. Go right into July and August. Go check them out at WWE.com. Plus, starting June 23rd on the USA Network, I am hosting Tough Enough. It's back bigger and better and better than ever. I'm the host of the show. I'm going to be like a glorified, muscled up Ryan Seacrest. Actually, we've got a lot of surprises. It's going to be an amazing, amazing program. I think if you like Tough Enough before, you're going to love it even more now. And if you love good time rock and roll, come check out some shows Fozzy's got this summer. June 25th, the Val Air Ballroom in Des Moines, Iowa. June 26th at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Sioux City, Iowa. July 24th at the Square in Kitchener, Ontario. August 8th. We got the Festival of Friends in Hamilton, Ontario. August 9th, Heavy Montreal in Montreal. October 30th, we're heading out on the Kiss Cruise. Then, of course, we're heading over to England. The Cinderblock Party continues over there. That starts in November with Nonpoint. We're going everywhere, man. Go to FozzyRock.com. Check out all ticket information and VIP information. We put on one of the best VIP programs you're ever going to get. Ask around. Go to @FozzyRock for more detail. Go to FozzyRock for more detail. And don't forget, all you guys, if you want more details about some of our great sponsors like MeUndies, TrueCar, DDP Yoga, Recovery Max, Burger King, of course, Amazon, you go to podcastone.com. You click on the supporter show sponsors banner at the top of the page. They hit the Talk is Jericho button. Don't forget, you go shopping on Amazon. You go through my link. We get a couple bucks thrown back to us for expenses paid that we have to take care of, lights and microphones and gas for driving all over the continent of the United States, getting great guests for you guys. We got Amazon links for the U.S., the U.K., Canada. Every time we do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show, so we keep doing these for you for free for twice a week. No extra fees or hidden charges. You just get the shopping done and help me out in the process. You go to podcastone.com. You click on the supporter show sponsors banner at the top of the page. You wagey. Then you hit the Talk is Jericho button. All right. Thanks again to Bobby Hull. And this Friday, another crazy story. I got an old friend of mine. He's a warrior, wrestled for many years in ECW, and now he's found himself in a wheelchair, unable to walk, has a great attitude. He's totally clean and sober, and he needs your help. He's going to tell us all about it. It's the tragic tale of Axel Rotten. It's coming up on Friday. I'm looking forward to seeing you then. I'm looking forward to talking to Axel, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. I love you. Good day. Good night. Stay hard. Stay hungry. And, yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Longtime listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know,
When you switch to GEICO, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call GEICO, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.